Welcome to Dig, a history podcast. Everyone has heard the phrase, freedom isn't free. Now, that phrase has overtly political connotations, instructing those that hear it to support wars without questioning whether they're moral or just. Plus, there are also problems with too closely associating freedom with the price of bloodshed. But like so many stereotypes and aphorisms, there is a kernel of truth there. War is expensive. Of course, those of us that lived through the Bush years remember the phrase blood and treasure, indicating that wars are costly in terms of cash, but also costly in terms of lives lost and blood spilled. And while people have known this since time immemorial, in United States history, the moment that the nation first had to truly grapple with the extraordinary expenses of war was after the American Civil War.
As part of our series highlighting our own research fields, today we're talking about disability, trauma, gore, crime, extraordinary federal expenditures, and maybe even a penis or two. In other words, today we're talking about Sarah's research.
That's right. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Avril.
And we are your historians for this episode of Dig. To paraphrase a historian named John Kinder, wounded and sick veterans pose a real problem and have always posed a problem and continue to pose a problem for the United States government. Veterans occupy a weird place in our culture. We honor them for their service, but we also have asked them to go through sometimes incredibly damaging experiences, experiences that cause mental and physical damage, which are really expensive to compensate. So one of the problems is that we can't not compensate them because they're heroes, but also, geez, it is super expensive. Embedded within that problem are lots of other problems. For example, American culture has a real stigma against mental illness and physical disability, but these heroes often are profoundly disabled by their war service. Or how about this one? A lot of Americans really hate public support systems, but veterans rely on a lot of public support. A lot of Americans really hate bureaucracy and government spending, but veterans require a lot and have created a lot of bureaucracy and government spending.
From the beginning, the government has tried to find ways to solve this problem. For the 25,000 or so men who were wounded or sickened during the Revolutionary War, the government offered support in the form of invalid pensions. Invalid pensions were only given to men who had disabilities that they could trace back to the war. The Revolutionary veterans did have some service pensions, or pensions given simply for having served in the Army. But these were limited and often came in the form of free land rather than cash, like the feudalism of old. The majority of support came in the form of invalid pensions, though. In order to get your pension, you needed to prove to the government that you were sufficiently disabled, that you had served honorably, and that your disability could, in fact, be traced back to the war. Veterans of later wars, specifically the War of 1812 and the Mexican-American War, also used the same system.
At the beginning of the Civil War, few people really believed that this war would be particularly long or bloody, so many assumed that the pension system would work in more or less the same way. By July 1862, however, it was becoming clear that the scale of death and bodily harm during this war was going to be significantly different than in previous wars. In response, Congress passed a piece of legislation entitled An Act to Grant Pensions, which outlined how the federal government would support Union soldiers harmed in the line of duty. It also provided pensions to survivors, including widows, mothers, orphaned children, and I say orphaned sort of in quotes there because they often use the term orphan to refer to children who had lost their father. Hmm. So their mother might still be alive, but for some reason they still consider that being an orphan, probably because the breadwinner was gone. Mm-hmm. And even in some cases, sisters. Disabled veterans were entitled to a certain amount per month based on their rank and based on their disability rating. In other words, based on how disabled they were. The Pension Bureau determined rates of disability based on one standard: how capable the veteran might be to perform manual labor. They didn't invent this standard. It had been the same one used during the Revolutionary War. And in fact, I think it was also used during like the Napoleonic Wars. But it also sometimes meant some really twisted logic. For instance, a farmer who suffered from debilitating diarrhea and therefore weakness and constant sickness that would make farming, you know, really difficult, would be considered less disabled than a white collar worker who had lost one leg, which probably wouldn't interfere very much with his ability to do an office job.
Rating disability based on men's ability or inability to perform manual labor meant that the federal government was not compensating soldiers based on their wounds, but instead on their potential lost income. To look at it another way, the pensions, ideally, were designed to make up for the work soldiers could no longer perform. But this often seemed arbitrary. Take, for instance, Charles F. Manderson, the former colonel of the 19th Ohio Infantry. Manderson had been leading a charge at the Battle of Lovejoy Station when he was shot in the right side of his body. Doctors weren't able to remove the ball, which caused spinal damage and resulted in temporary paralysis. Manderson was unable to return to his command and received a disability discharge in April 1865. His pension application was quickly and easily approved. After the war, Manderson became a lawyer and then went on to become a senator from Nebraska. In the 1880s, Manderson was experiencing some secondary effects of his wound and so had some surgical examinations in hopes of raising his $15 pension rating. These examinations revealed that the injury was getting worse and would likely paralyze Manderson again. When Manderson applied for an increase in his pension based on this new development, he was denied. But because he had some political clout, he was able to get his pension pushed through.
Right. So just to give a little bit of background here, the guy that actually pushed that pension through was the commissioner of pensions at the time, whose name was James Tanner. James Tanner was a disabled veteran himself. He had actually lost both legs during the war, and he was a kind of high-ranking member of a veterans organization we're going to talk about in a few minutes called the Grand Army of the Republic, and just a huge proponent of expanding pension benefits wherever he could. So whenever he saw a situation like this, especially for someone with some political clout that he might be able to call on later, he would push that pension through, even if, you know, the Pension Bureau actually denied that claim. And if you're interested in James Tanner, there's a fantastic book on him by a historian named James Martin. I highly recommend it. Okay, so now this is another moment. The story about Manderson is another moment where we see the problem of the American veteran. From one point of view, that increase in Manderson's pension makes perfect sense. After all, he was shot, he was temporarily paralyzed, he was continuing to have serious health ramifications based on that wound, a wound that was received in the line of duty to the American government and its people. But at the same time, Manderson was not in any need of cash. He was a lawyer and a congressman. He could still work. Another element to Manderson's story is that he did not look like the prototypical disabled veteran. He hadn't lost an arm or a leg or even a finger. He'd been shot through the body. When he was dressed, no one could tell that he was injured. How could he really be so disabled that he needed large, regular payments from the government? And just as another side note here, because this is my research, and so I'm going to offer you 1,000 side notes, but Averill sort of joked at the top of the episode that we might mention a penis or two, and a big chunk of my research over the past, oh my God, 5 or 6 years has been about a Union general named Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, who was shot through the hips, a wound that implicated his penis and made him, he couldn't urinate in a typical manner. He was impotent. So when he applied for pensions, he was also denied, or he was denied at least, you know, significant or large payments because he had a hard time proving that those kinds of hidden or invisible wounds actually impacted his daily life. Mm-hmm. It was much easier to prove that you had been, you know, catastrophically injured if you were missing an arm. That mm-hmm. made sense to people. But these kind of invisible or non-visible disabilities were really hard to prove. And then the Pension Bureau, even if they approved them for a certain rating, wouldn't rate them very high because they just couldn't believe or refuse to believe that they would impact your ability to do manual labor. Because Manderson was a public figure, he became a lightning rod for media criticism. Even though veterans were among the most honored members of American society, that didn't mean that they didn't face criticism, especially in terms of politics.
Veterans were almost universally members of the Republican Party. Over the course of the war, around 2.2 million men served in the Union Army. When those veterans mustered out of the Army and returned to civilian life, they became a massive voting bloc. Since most veterans were Republicans, the Republican Party worked tirelessly to keep their votes by becoming the party that would protect and honor veterans to a fault. No small number of veterans went on to become Republican politicians, and even more former soldiers joined a veterans organization called the Grand Army of the Republic, which Sarah just mentioned, which was a fraternal organization with massive lobbying power. But there were also a lot of Americans who resented the fact that these men seemed to have a special place in American society, getting handouts from the government. The Democratic Party used that resentment to mobilize the non-veterans by emphasizing the fact that veterans undeservedly got special treatment. Therefore, when the media caught wind of Charles Manderson, they whipped the story up into an outrage against the American public. The editors of the Illustrated American pointed out that Manderson seemed, for all accounts, able-bodied. Here's a quote. "The paralysis never came. Mr. Manderson's health was perfect, and his wound did not interfere with his indulging in dancing, an art in which he delighted." The editors of the Harrisburg Patriot put an even finer point on the matter, declaring, "Manderson is neither a disabled man nor a needy one. He ought to be ashamed to be a beggar, a pensioner upon the bounty of men poorer than himself." Eventually, the criticism blew Manderson's pension into an all-out scandal, to the point where Secretary of the Interior John W. Noble wrote Manderson a letter chastising him for accepting the pension payout. Manderson, likely humiliated by the imputation that he was something of a mercenary, returned some of his payment and requested that his pension be returned to its original lower rating.
Part of the reason that Manderson faced such intense scrutiny was because of one of the oldest stories in the history of disability, the fear of dependency. People in the 19th century had a deep-seated loathing for the idea that certain people were, or had the potential to become, dependent upon the public charge, or to put it bluntly, charity cases and welfare bums. This fear dates all the way back to poor laws passed in the 17th century in England that established that poor relief, or another term for charity, should be reserved for the worthy poor. In other words, for people who really deserved it. Women, children, and in some cases people of color were considered worthy because they were supposed to be dependent upon others, specifically on men, right? All of those groups are kind of reliant upon men to provide and take care of them. On the other hand, others were considered the unworthy poor, or what most 19th century people called paupers. They were considered unworthy because they should have been able to be self-sufficient, but they were instead asking for a handout. Nearly all poor relief efforts created after this point, this law is passed in about 1601, so everything that was created after this point was heavily influenced by this line of reasoning. Providing support to the unworthy poor would only encourage them to become dependent on charity and discourage them from going back to work. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, there are states right now in June 2018, in case this episode's being listened to way down the road, there are states that are putting work requirements on Medicaid for exactly this same line of reasoning. So people in both the 17th and the 19th century expected men to work. When men were unable to work, they faced stigma and scrutiny, even if they were legitimately disabled. Manderson was disabled, but that didn't matter. He was able to work, proven by his law office and his service in the Senate, and therefore he did not deserve a pension no matter what.
So we've seen that there was a tension that existed when it came to the American civilian public after the war. They were supposed to honor and support veterans, but they also sort of distrusted and maybe even resented veterans. Pensions became a particularly contentious issue because in the decades after the war, pension funding went up and up and up and up. Under the 1862 law, pensions were only available to men who became disabled in the line of duty. In 1879, the law was amended in what was called the Arrears Act. This made it possible for soldiers who did not apply for the pension immediately, but applied later, to collect lump sum payments for any back payments they would have received if they had applied earlier. This was not very popular with the public. For some, this seemed like it provided incentive for men to invent disabilities in order to apply and then receive a big check. In the 1880s, things became even more contentious when the Grand Army of the Republic and other veterans groups began pushing Republican politicians to pass a huge new pension bill. This bill was designed to expand pension payments to all soldiers and veterans who had served, and then who had gone on to develop unrelated disabilities. However, the timing was terrible. The president was Grover Cleveland, a fiscally conservative Democrat who hated the pension system and who loved vetoing things. The bill created a massive Democratic outcry in the late 1880s, which just intensified public scrutiny of disabled veterans. Were they really disabled? Were they just able-bodied men looking for a handout? Were they, gasp, paupers?
Oh my gosh.
What happens in the press during the late 1880s is really fascinating, at least to me. Of course, the press is caught in the same trap as the rest of the public. They want to criticize veterans for being welfare bummers, but they can't be too harsh or else they'll not only alienate a huge voting bloc, but also piss off millions of Americans who feel like it's their patriotic duty to support America's wounded warriors. So the press starts to do something very interesting. They annihilate the proposed law, but they also say it's not the real Union soldiers who want to pass this law. Real Union soldiers don't want pensions. They don't need pensions. Real American veterans are self-sufficient, and they're honorable, and they wouldn't dream of taking money from the American government. Instead, the veterans who want to take that money and expand the pension system are losers and bad soldiers. They often categorize them into groups associated with either cowardice or money grubbing, specifically malingerers, or soldiers who fake disabilities, and mercenaries, soldiers who fight not out of duty, but for money. So in other words, they find a rhetorical workaround to ensure that they can both criticize veterans and say that they're not really criticizing veterans. They're criticizing bad soldiers who don't deserve honor or financial support. And I just want to point out that this bill didn't pass. It was so, you know, roundly pilloried that it lost a lot of support outside of the Grand Army of the Republic. It was vetoed by Grover Cleveland, who loved the veto more than any other president before or since. He vetoed more legislation than anyone. However, as soon as Cleveland left office, the bill was passed in 1890. Hmm. So this rhetorical workaround also comes in handy when it comes to veterans behaving badly in the decades after the war. So this is actually where we come to the research that I'm currently working on, veterans and crime after the Civil War.
In July 1865, the editors of the Jackson, Michigan newspaper, The Patriot, declared, "Surely this is the age of crime." This declaration was prompted by a small rash of violent events involving newly discharged Union veterans. In the first incident, a soldier from the 1st Michigan Artillery complained of a toothache and took a small dose of opium to ease the pain, naturally.
As one does.
As one does. Finding that the dose didn't help, he swallowed another teaspoonful. It's always a good idea.
Not a good plan.
No, I mean, follow the directions on your pill bottles or drug bottles.
On your opium vials.
Within a few hours, the young soldier was dead. A few days later, another discharged Union soldier named Joseph S. Henry stabbed a local man named Daniel Smoke to death. Henry seemed to have been a fairly rough character and was leaving town with some companions, including Mary Johnson, who had just been released from the local jail where she'd been held on charges of prostitution.
Mary Johnson.
Hey-o.
Oh, yeah.
They were confronted by Smoke, who tried to, for unknown reasons, to get them to stay. Maybe he was in love with Mary Johnson.
Maybe he was her pimp.
Maybe he was her pimp. But I like the love story better.
Sure, sure, sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The two men exchanged words, and within a few minutes, Smoke was bleeding to death.
The pages of Northern...
Wait. He got smoked.
I have to say, Daniel Smoke, that's a badass name.
Yeah,
yeah,
man.
Like that.
It sounds like a stabber.
It's a good stripper name.
The pages of Northern newspapers were full of these kinds of reports in the months following the demobilization. One newspaper went so far as to say that crime was so rampant in one town in Indiana that the citizens go armed. But regardless of these reports, the question of whether there actually was a crime wave in the summer of 1865, as the Jackson Patriot alleged, has been, you know, hotly debated, particularly between economist Edith Abbott and historian Eric Monkanen, although their historiographical beef was separated by like 70 years, which I think is really funny. They're like arguing with each other, but Edith Abbott's been dead for like decades and decades and decades.
Maybe it's like that movie Lake House where like one leaves the piece of their argument in the mailbox at the house, and then 50 years earlier, she pulls it out and she's like, God damn it!
Yes, I think that's what it's... I think that's exactly what happened. Okay. So, anyway. So we'll start with Edith Abbott's side of this debate. In 1927, Abbott wrote an article called The Civil War and the Crime Wave of 1865 to 70. In it, she argued that there was an increase in crime. For example, she says that in New York City, arrests swelled by 25% in 1865. Convictions in New York City for quote-unquote state prison offenses, which I'm assuming are, you know, more serious crimes, nearly doubled from 1864 to 1865.
It seems other states also noticed a rise in veterans as offenders. Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia had an influx of ex-soldiers in the years following the war. Kansas State Penitentiary reported that the majority of convicts they received in 1867 were Union veterans. The arrest and imprisonment of veterans must have been common enough to attract notice because it became a concern for prison aid societies and state governments. Jeremiah Willits, a member of the Philadelphia Society for Alleviating the Miseries of Public Prisons, conducted a multi-state investigation of prisons in 1869 to 1870 and concluded that 75% of the recent admissions in each prison he visited were Union veterans. In his report, he also stated that most of the imprisoned veterans were first-time offenders, and that many admitted that they had committed their crimes because, quote, the moral hedge had been weakened by the Army association and practices. So here we see an explanation that is repeated over and over again during this 5 to 10 year period after the war's end, that the apparent surge in crime is because of the immoral influence of military service and warfare on men. And this is the explanation that Edith Abbott embraced in her essay, that the war created some kind of social rift that caused an uptick in violence and crime.
While they aren't necessarily statistically significant, there sure is a lot of discussion about veterans and crime in the press in the years after the war. Even as decades passed, the public remained fascinated by veterans who committed crimes, especially violent crimes. For instance, in July 1882, veteran James Hawks and his wife both drank too much. At some point, Hawks stabbed his wife through the heart. When police told him that she had died, he muttered only, "It's a damned good thing." Oh, man. Charles Harrison slit his wife's throat in March 1888 when he discovered her walking down the street with another man.
You said that so jauntily. He slit his wife's throat.
It's like when our intern was all like, murder.
Yeah.
In May of 1886, a veteran named James Scullion This is one of my favorite stories of all time, by the way. James Scullion attacked and beat to death a man with his wooden prosthetic leg because he believed that the man had been wielding a knife. After the man died, it was discovered that the knife was actually his cane. So he was also a disabled man.
He could have had a knife hidden in the handle. We don't know.
Yeah, you never know. Two veterans in the same time period there, Lewis Schmidt and W.F. Reuter, who both lived in the Milwaukee branch of the National Home for Disabled Volunteer Soldiers, kind of a old age home for veterans of the Civil War, they got into a drunken argument about the war. Schmidt, apparently deeply offended, and later waited for Reuter on the road back to the home, stabbed the man in the belly, then promptly turned himself in as a murderer. In January 1888, an old veteran named George Holford was found lying, dead, and clutching a revolver on the carpet next to his marital bed, where lay his estranged wife's body. Their marriage had been deeply troubled, and when their son learned that his mother had not come down for dinner, his first thought was, "I bet he's killed her."
As many of these stories show, wives were often those in the greatest danger. Alvadine Fisk was an accomplished medium and spiritualist who had married Union veteran Alfred Smith in 1865 after he returned from his 3 years' service in the 12th New York Cavalry. The couple lived in upstate New York and had two children. While Alfred worked as a sailor on the Great Lakes and dock worker in the port of Oswego, New York. But as time passed, Alfred began to drink heavily and neglect the family, leaving Alvadine and the children to rely on her career as a medium as their only means of support. Alfred became violent and beat Alvadine until, fearing for her own and her children's lives, she left her husband and filed for divorce. The couple reconciled, though, so the divorce was never completed, and they moved to Cleveland for a fresh start.
As, you know, everyone, when they think, I need a fresh start.
Cleveland.
I move into Cleveland.
Sounds pretty fresh. The reconciliation, though, it did not last. Cleveland did not deliver on the fresh start.
Damn it, Cleveland.
6 years later, Alfred began to drink and abuse his family again. This time, a friend and fellow spiritualist named Louisa Jane Wilson convinced Alvadine to again file for divorce. Alvadine filed the papers, packed Alfred's bags, and asked him to leave the house. He cursed and threatened to kill her, but he left. Fearing the worst, Alvadine sent the children to stay with friends. Then she and Mrs. Wilson went to bed.
They went to separate beds.
Sure they did. The next morning, they were discovered laying in their blood-soaked beds, their heads beaten in with hammers.
Ugh.
They were in the same bed. They were in different beds.
They were in different beds. That's why it says they're blood-soaked beds.
All right.
Ruin the, like, kicker of the story.
Okay,
you're
I'll try.
Their heads were beaten in with hammers. They were in the same bed.
Sorry. I'll fix it. Okay. The next morning, they were discovered lying in their blood-soaked beds, their heads beaten in with a hammer. Alfred was lying beside the dead Alvadine, choking on his own blood. He had tried to commit suicide by slitting his own throat, but failed, as he did in his marriage.
Yeah.
He survived and was sentenced to life in prison. What? I mean, it's actually, if you're Marissa, a good story, because it's murdery, but... sad.
Yeah, it's a terrible story. Especially what makes me sad about that story is that Alvadine tried so hard to get away from him.
And she also tried to, like, we can fix it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a story about domestic violence, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's what all of these stories are.
But I mean, that is
oh, like the coming
over,
back and,
over you know, centuries right. That has been like the thing that remains true about domestic violence, right? Is that it's very hard to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very often women who do leave die.
Mm-hmm.
Because their husbands kill them or their partners kill them.
Mm-hmm.
A more famous wife murder was that of Clara Harris Rathbone at the hands of her husband, Colonel Henry Rathbone. During the war, Rathbone was a lawyer and an officer in the Union Army, and Clara was a Washington, D.C. socialite and friend of Mary Todd Lincoln. On April 14th, 1865, when Ulysses S. Grant and his wife Julia had politely declined attending the theater with them, the Lincolns had invited the then engaged couple to join them in seeing Our American Cousin at Ford's Theater. I think everyone sees where this is going, right? While the group was engrossed in the play, actor and Southern sympathizer John Wilkes Booth snuck into their box and shot the president in the back of the head. Rathbone tried to seize the assassin, but Booth slashed his arm open with a knife and then jumped over the balcony, leaving Rathbone bleeding and powerless to stop him. After the assassination, although Rathbone's terrible wound did eventually heal, the rest of him did not. He continued to suffer from heart palpitations and shortness of breath for no apparent reason, and he grew increasingly paranoid that someone was plotting to injure his wife and children. On Christmas Eve, 1883, while the family was on holiday in Germany, Rathbone fell into a powerful hallucination. He shot Clara, then mangled himself with a knife in much the same way that he had been mangled by John Wilkes Booth in April 1865. Friends and acquaintances all agreed that the trauma of the assassination caused Rathbone's mental breakdown. The colonel spent the remainder of his life in a German mental institution. That story is so, I mean, it's been seized upon by sort of conspiracy theorists that, like, there was something paranormal about the Lincoln assassination that, like, there was a curse that was cast by this horrible event, this assassination that caused Rathbone to, you know, go crazy. But that to me is just really, well, obviously it's stupid, but I mean, it's also like, shows me the lengths that people will go to deny that people are horrifically traumatized by traumatizing events, right? Yeah. Like, it should come as absolutely no surprise that Rathbone would be powerfully disturbed by this event. That not only that he was mangled and his wife was threatened, but that he was sitting inches away from the president of the United States and could do nothing to stop him from being assassinated. I mean, it's...
Was it the Rathbone's box or was it the Lincoln's box?
I don't know who owned the box or who paid for the box, but I mean, it was the Lincolns invited the Rathbones. Okay, it wasn't the Rathbones.
So he didn't feel guilt for inviting the Lincolns.
No. The Lincolns invited them because Ulysses S. Grant and his wife were like, oh, we hate Mary Todd Lincoln. We don't want to go to the theater with them. And so they didn't.
So this is really fascinating stuff. And
well, thank you.
I mean, it's pretty touching.
Pretty touching. I mean, you seem very touched by it.
It adds anecdotal evidence to the idea that the Civil War unleashed something dark and violent in American society. The problem is, however, that just that it's anecdotal.
Right. The plural of what? Anecdote is not data. Right? Isn't that how that goes?
That's a thing?
I think so.
Oh, that's funny. I've never heard that.
So, like, you can have lots of anecdotes, yeah. But it doesn't necessarily prove anything.
But if you got 1,000 anecdotes...
Maybe, yeah, but it's not. It's also not statistically significant, right?
So Edith Abbott might have added these terrible stories to her arsenal in support of her theory that something was altered in American society because of the Civil War. But not everyone agreed with Ms. Abbott's argument. Crime historian Eric, how do you say that again?
I say it Monkanen.
I like that. Sounds good.
But I don't actually know.
Sorry, Eric. Crime historian. He's dead? All right. Yeah. Sorry, Eric's children. Crime historian Eric Monkanen argued that crime and imprisonment rates did not rise because the war created a more violent populace, but because the population who would have been committing crimes had started committing crimes again upon their return from their military service. His explanation of the apparent onslaught of soldiers and veterans in northern prisons is that so many northern men had served that any influx of prisoners would look like it was because of the war or linked to the military. In other words, he argues that Abbott mistook correlation for causation.
Right. Oldest problem in the book.
Oldest trick in the book. He writes, quote, "The post-Civil War phenomenon of soldiers flooding into prisons was simply an artifact of the widespread mobilization. It would have been hard to find any young male who had not had a war experience. The linkage of war and violence combines bad reasoning and little research." Bazinga.
Damn. Oh boy. So when I first started doing this research many, 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 many years ago, I was really interested in trauma. I was writing a lot about mental illness and trauma for my first project, so it was sort of on my brain. And I started to think about these other newspaper articles that I was finding as I was researching, right? Some of these things that we've already told you about. Veterans committing crimes, murdering, hurting their wives, committing suicide, drinking, generally leading miserable lives and inflicting pain on others. I mean, that's a serious oversimplification. But I did start to wonder whether or not the war did inflict some kind of social wound, somehow changing or altering the social fabric of the North in such a way that led to an increase in crime, among other social ills. Now, that research didn't make it very far. I was a little thrown by this debate between Edith Abbott and Eric Malkonen. I really kind of thought that it was a dead end, right? That I was seeing all this stuff, and my thought was, I'm just seeing what I want to see, right? I'm just finding evidence that I hope is there. And so I'm kind of falling into Edith Abbott's trap. And I was also worried that without being a quantitative historian or being an economist, I didn't think that there was any way that I could solve this puzzle. But now, as I'm coming back to this research for the first time in many years, I'm actually now much less interested in whether or not there was an honest-to-goodness social wound that somehow caused a surge in crime. And I'm much more interested in the fact that the Northern public believed that there was a surge in crime. And whether the Civil War caused a rise in violence or a surge in crime, it seems fairly clear that there were veterans going to prison in large numbers in the years between 1865 and 1875. From newspaper articles, editorials, speeches, and prison reform reports, it also seems very clear that Northern citizens saw a connection between war service and criminality.
For example, the editors of the Salt Lake City Telegraph wrote that the war had been like a great wave, which broke and started to recede after the Lincoln assassination. They wrote, quote, "It was thought that the breeze which fanned its receding and crimson crest would also cool the red-hot passions of men and stop the flow of human blood. But in rolling back the mighty tidal wave of misery, the white-winged messenger of peace failed to allay the human passions, and red-handed murder, rapine, and incendiarism still hold high carnival in the land." So this phrase, crime holding high carnival or a carnival of crime, became really popular during this period, repeated over and over, according to historian Gregory Land. This quote suggests that Americans believed that the war had unleashed something that was beyond control. Successfully waging war meant engaging certain human passions that, once unleashed, could not be controlled. But again, we find ourselves running into the same problem. Veterans were supposed to be the very best the country had to offer. Many historians have written about how Americans thought about the war as a crucible for manhood, honing and perfecting boys into the epitome of citizenship. So here's a weird thing then, all right? How could war both create criminals and create ideal citizens?
This is another real tension for the American public. We see the war being described in so many contradictory ways. It's a rite of passage from boyhood to manhood. It's a glorious crusade to end slavery and to restore the Union. But it's also a tidal wave of misery that brought about a tolerance for rape and murder and general unrest. I mean, this is a real problem, right? I mean, this doesn't make any sense. To me, this brings me back to the media debates about pensions. Americans had to find a way to have their cake and eat it too. They did this by again sorting veterans into good and bad categories. Good veterans were held to a standard that in my first project I refer to as the true soldier of Union. This was a construction. It never really existed. But instead, it was an idealized perfect soldier that embodied everything that was good and noble about Union soldiers and therefore Union veterans. These were loyal volunteer soldiers who enlisted for the purest of reasons, never for money or adventure, only out of a devotion to their country. Veterans who committed crimes could not meet that ideal, and therefore, they weren't really veterans. They didn't count. For example, the New York Herald Tribune was so reluctant to blame the newly demobilized soldiers for a rise in crime in July 1865 that they refused to refer to a veteran who had raped and murdered two children in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, as a soldier at all. Instead, the man was, quote, that meanest of all villains, a professional bounty jumper. They went on to explain that, quote, it will not detract from the well-earned good character of the majority of our soldiers if it should be found that a few of them are capable of brutal and unmentionable crimes. The return of peace will unquestionably let loose upon society a considerable number of unscrupulous and degraded men, and their restraint and reformation will demand the constant attention both of the officers of the law and agents of philanthropic associations. So in this way, they were able to keep the idealized soldier of Union trope while also blaming the war and the army for the degradation of morals that led to such horrific crimes. This was, in a sense, a kind of ideological coping mechanism.
While Edith Abbott and Eric Mankinen spent a great deal of time debating, although they were separated by 70-something years.
Right, through the mailbox at
right,
the lake
through
house.
Through the mailbox, yeah. Whether there was a surge in crime, what they don't discuss is who are these soldier criminals? What kinds of crimes did former soldiers commit? What were their motivations? Of course, some veterans committed crimes after the war because they liked it. But it seems likely that others committed crimes because they were unable to cope with the lingering trauma of their war service.
And we do have some evidence to back this theory up. So I'll leave you with a story that I take no credit for. Both Patrick Lewis of the Civil War Governors of Kentucky Project and Diane Miller Somerville, who's a history professor at Binghamton University, have recently written about Medal of Honor winner Lieutenant Robert Buffum, who was captured as part of the Andrews Raid and kept in horrific conditions in the Confederate Chattanooga Prisoner of War Camp. After he left the Army, Buffum became an alcoholic. When he held a shop owner at gunpoint and demanded a new pair of shoes, Buffum was sent to a Kentucky penitentiary. This penitentiary was run for profit, and convicts were required to work long hours in intense heat, making cloth and rope out of hemp fibers. Convicts inhaled the fibers, and it was not uncommon for men to die of respiratory ailments caused by this lung irritant. After his release, he wandered the country in search of work. And I should say he was only released because people lobbied to the president saying, you know, he's a war hero. You need to let him free. And so they did. But after his release, he wandered the country in search of work. He abandoned his wife and family. He was unable to keep a job because he was drinking heavily and he was dealing with mental illness, what we suspect was probably something akin to post-traumatic stress disorder. In 1870, he murdered a friend's father. We don't have a lot of evidence or a lot of information about this murder. We don't really know why. We just know that they were sitting down to dinner at a restaurant. He stood up and he shot him. Buffum was again sent to prison, first to Sing Sing and then to the New York State Asylum for the Criminally Insane in Auburn, New York. In Sing Sing, Buffum tried to kill himself by jumping off of his bunk, flinging himself again and again into the floor until he was, quote, covered in gore. During his trial, he tried to explain his actions and his despondency by saying, quote, by my service to my country, I have been made a pauper, a lunatic, and a criminal. But then he also stated that he would do it all over again, if he had to save the Union. Buffum was then sent to the New York State Asylum for the Criminally Insane in Auburn. There, in July 1871, he sliced his own throat with a razor and died. How many more Robert Buffums are there whose failure to cope with war trauma led them to a life of wandering and crime? What were their experiences in places like the Kentucky Penitentiary, in Sing Sing, in the Auburn Asylum for the Criminally Insane? Robert Buffum was no professional bounty jumper, right? To the contrary, he was a Medal of Honor winner. So stories like his sort of let the air out of the argument put forth by contemporary media that only the worst veterans, right? These bad veterans became criminals. So, you know, how did people try to make sense of men like Robert Buffum? I don't really know yet, but that's what I'm working on right now. So I hope to find out.
It also sort of pokes a hole into Mankinen's argument that only criminals who joined the army who were always going to be criminals right. ended up being criminals after the war.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because obviously people like the Abraham Lincoln box, what's his name?
Henry Rathbone.
Henry mm-hmm. Rathbone or this Buffum, they're, you know, the life of crime was not in their cards until after the trauma of the war.
Right. Absolutely. And Buffum himself links it explicitly to the war. Right. He mm-hmm. says this is what the war did to me.
Right.
Or, you know, and for him, it had a lot to do with his time in the Chattanooga prison camp, that it was just an extremely traumatic experience and mm-hmm. it ruined him. And, you know, this is something that I've grappled with a lot, not so much in terms of crime, but in terms of trauma. There are a lot of people, I mean, I'm not going to get into the big kind of historiographical debates that are going on within Civil War history right now. It's kind of been a knockdown, dragout fight over whether or not the Civil War created trauma or traumatized people that took part in it. This is like a really big contentious issue. But there are a lot of people who want to say that, that, you know, soldiers during the Civil War weren't particularly traumatized. And if there were, then it's such a small number that they're not statistically significant. And focusing on them is really marginal. But something that I see over and over again, at least in my first project, is people saying what Buffum said, right? That
mm-hmm.
that my life is like this because of the war,
right?
Right? Like I was this way before I entered the army, and now I live in an asylum and mm-hmm. I haven't seen my family in 30 years, right? Like before the war, I was fine. Now I'm miserable all the time and I hate my life. Or mm-hmm. families saying, listen, like writing to the supervisors of asylums or writing to pension bureaucrats and saying, my brother, my husband, whoever was perfectly healthy. And then I sent him to you and you sent me back this, and they use the term wreck of humanity, mm-hmm. right? So they're seeing this link. I think it's really dismissive to say that that doesn't matter, right? That this is, they're so marginal that it doesn't matter to how we think about the Civil War.
Right. Because even if it is something that you're seeing just because that's the population that you're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
That doesn't mean that's not important.
Right.
Or an important part of the story.
Like, right. Yeah. I mean, this project that I'm working on right now on crime, I mean, it's in its very, very earliest stages. And I want to be really clear that, you know, I don't know, and I'm not saying that there was a surge in crime after the war
right.
that was caused by the war. Yeah. I mean, I tend to sort of side with Eric Mankonen on that, on the, you know, a large group of people who would be, like, let's say, for instance, a large population of sort of otherwise impoverished Irish immigrants in New York City, instead of being at home in New York City, you know, joining gangs and causing a ruckus, we're in the Union Army. And then when they come sure. back, then they start joining gangs and causing a ruckus. Like, that makes sense, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that it's really compelling that people are saying at the time, no, this is obviously because of the war.
Right.
You know, this is obviously people are seeing a connection.
Don't you think criminal sorts would find ways to not serve a government that they, you know, that might be persecuting them and trying to break up their gangs and take away their, I don't know, control of the heroin on the east side?
They certainly did try. Right. I mean, you know, there was the New York City draft riots, which right. was, you know, particularly, you know, the largest group that was kind of feeling persecuted by that were Irish yeah. immigrants, because exactly. they felt like, you know, rich man's war, poor man's fight. We're being drafted into this. We have no dog in this fight.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to fight. And particularly seeing Black people as the cause of that, right?
Right.
Like, we're racist. We don't want right. to fight on behalf of Black people.
Right.
But at the same time, they didn't have a lot of sway.
Right.
So they end up, I mean, there are stories about enlistment officers standing at the docks and saying, like, you want 3 square meals a day? Like, sign here.
Hmm.
And people being just, like, literally pushed right into the army.
Mm-hmm.
Then again, hmm. you know, they served in the army, then they got pensions for the rest of their life, at least many of them. So they, you know, and some of them died. So, you know, either way.
Yeah.
I was going to say something, but now I can't. Oh, so I... I'm not a quantitative historian, and I'm not an economist, and I'm actually extremely bad at math. But just recently, I was at a conference. I was at the Society of Civil War Historians conference, where I first sort of debuted some of the things that we've been talking about today. And a colleague of mine named Megan Kate Nelson suggested, you know, an interesting way to look at this question of whether or not it was just, you know, whether crime rates would have been that high if these people hadn't left, you know what I mean, is to look at crime rates in camp. Like, to say, choose, like, a New York City regiment that maybe had a bunch of those people that you might associate with rabble-rousing and crime. And look at them while they're in the war. Were there high rates of crime in their unit? Like, were there lots of court-martials? Were there lots of discipline problems? And then compare it, like, when they go home, does their, say, borough of New York City, is that consistent with what it's been like during the war? Or did it go way up? Or were they committing different kinds of crimes? Suddenly they're committing tons of murders. But for 4 years in the army, they were, you know, doing things like drinking and maybe getting into a fist fight. You know, how does that kind of line up? And I think that's a really, might be a really interesting way of looking at it.
I also like the question of, are the crimes that they're committing different? Right? That's indicative of something. To have a hallucination that you're being attacked and then shoot your wife and then also mutilate yourself.
Right.
That's pretty... intense.
And that's much different than, like, robbing the corner store.
Right, he's like, or even the, you know, even this guy, the last guy, obviously he, did he really need to steal a pair of shoes?
Well,
did he?
His argument was that, yes, he did. He had really, the Confederates had given him really shoes. So he just was like, damn it, I'm a member of the Union Army. Give me a great pair of shoes. But either way, you know, it's illegal to steal shoes.
Sure.
So at gunpoint, no less.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like he probably could have been like, hey, Dad.
Or it was an irrational response either way. Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's another reason why I hope to look at, like, prison records and see, like, what kinds of offenses are people committing. And then something I want to look at, too, is people like Buffum specifically who are then sent to asylums for the criminally insane, which there are several in New York State. And I want to see sort of. What was their deal? How did they make sense of what was going on in their lives? And I know from looking at other asylum records that they do often talk about the war. They chalk things up to their experience in the war. So I wonder if kind of the element of crime added to that will somehow change the way they talk about the war, or if they'll connect that to the war in some way. And this is kind of the peril of historical research. I could also find nothing.
Are you going to go back to St. Elizabeth's too?
Probably not, because they wasn't for criminals.
Oh.
It was different institutions for criminals. So,
okay.
Interesting. St. Elizabeth's is, for those who don't know, St. Elizabeth's is the, used to be called the government asylum for, insane soldiers. It was specifically for members of the military who, you know, had mental illness. They could go there for free, basically.
It's in D.C.
It's in D.C. and it's, records are in the National Archives, which is nice because they're not sealed.
Right.
In New York State, all asylum records are controlled under mental hygiene laws, and I have to go through a really lengthy and onerous process to get access to them. And unfortunately, prison records are the same story. But, you know, I've already gone through that process once. So
you're an old hand.
I am, yeah. Either that or I say all the time I'm going to sue New York State. To unseal those records.
You do have a lawyer at your side.
It's true.
Yes.
But, you know, I don't know. We'll see.
Okay. Thanks for sharing your research with us today, Sarah.
Thanks. I hope it wasn't really boring.
And everyone who is listening, if you enjoy the Civil War, which is weird, but I'm sure some people out there do.
It was not me.
It's the most awesome.
It's the most wonderful
topic. Then you
should
buy Sarah's upcoming book.
Yeah, Sarah has a book coming out.
We're going to do another episode about that.
About your book coming out?
Yes.
But we're just going to be like, let's sit down with the author today.
We're going to shill my book real hard.
Well, we're shilling it right now.
It's not out yet.
It's forthcoming from the University of Georgia. You know, eventually it'll be cheap on paperback, but the first edition will probably be hardcover. So you're going to have to pony up for the
and you should.
$60.
Because I deserve it.
Yes. She will get the royalties, and then she won't have to live in a box on the street anymore.
That's true.
Yeah.
You guys need to help me.
Yeah. But that's all I have for today. thank you for listening, everyone. If you haven't already and you are enjoying this podcast, feel free to leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, podcast, I don't know, wherever you get your podcasts. Make sure you're following us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. We also have a super fun kind of secret, not really secret anymore because we've said it 8,000 times, the secret is out! Podcast group called Dig History Pod Squad. You can search for it and request to join it. We'd love to have you pop in there. We say, share weird history memes and Marissa asks weird questions like, if you could be a historical dinosaur, what would it be?
Right, yeah. If you could be a historical figure's pet, which person would you be?
Ooh, that's a good one.
That's a good one.
I would be Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain's horse, baby.
You were close.
You have to cut that out.
That's going to be
it. It was a joke. But actually, his horse was really cool. His name was Charlemagne.
Yes, you would look.
That's why I said that.
Yeah, that's exactly why.
That's why. But he was impotent, so.
It's true. Yeah. It's true. See, we did get the penises.
The penis
in there.
Is back.
Mm-hmm. But if you can't, for some reason, if you can't find us on Facebook, if you can't find this pod squad, email us, send us a message on Twitter, add us on Twitter, and I'll make sure that you get the link.
Yeah. And we'd love to hear from you. So
yes.
On the Facebook group, send us an email, hello@digpodcast.org. Whatever, we love to hear from you. So.
Yeah.
So thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this special series.
Yeah, it feels very strange.
Of us giving you glimpses into our actual research.
Yeah. So don't be mean to us, also, because this is our day job.
Or our weekend job, because day job is teaching.
Our evening job. Yeah. Because we are teachers.
Scholars.
We work at teaching intensive places.
We work at teaching.
We do work at teaching.
No, but I mean we aren't at research university. Well, I'm at a research university, but I'm in a teaching position.
Oh,
so.
She is. She's at a research
but
university.
But I am. But
I know, I'm just
I was trying to make a point that we have positions that require us to teach a lot. And therefore researching is not our primary job, and it's difficult to sometimes get it in. But it's summer, so that means that
we're working
all the profs are doing their research.
Yup. Ciao. Oops, wrong button. This podcast was produced by the historians of Dig, Elizabeth Garner Masaryk, Sarah Hanley Cousins, Marissa Rhodes, and me, Avril Earls. Thanks for listening.
Press during the late 1880s is really fascinating, at least, to me. Of course. What?
You just laughed at your own.
I did.
That's so clever.
Fine, I'll take it out.
No, leave it in. Where you couldn't even speak the language of the other people.
You really know how to get to the real takeaway of a story.
This is
because truly it's about his inability to speak German and not his overriding trauma.
Easton State Penitentiary in
Easton State.
Did I say it weird?
You're a minor.
Easton State.
Eastern.
No, it's Eastern.
Eastern.
No, I don't know how to say it.
You don't know how to say the word Eastern? Eye
roll.
Eyeballs. Whenever you text eye roll and it comes out eyeball. There was a while there where we just kept texting each other eyeball. Oh,
the editors of the Illustrated... I pushed a button.
I was like, what did I do wrong?
Wait, I think I didn't say the whole sentence. So, rating...
Bye, guys. I'm quitting the podcast.
What is...
You sip coffee.
I didn't make it not loud
so
that time.
Loudly.
I didn't.
I forgive you. You're a slurper. You can't help yourself.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.